Welcome to the Whispering Willow podcast. I have a story for you. Settle in. This is The Dunwich Horror by H.P. Lovecraft. Chapter 1. When a traveler in north central Massachusetts takes the wrong fork at the junction of the Aylesbury Pike just beyond Dean's Corners, he comes upon a lonely and curious country. The ground gets higher, and the briar-bordered stone walls press closer and closer against the ruts of the dusty, curving road. The trees of the frequent forest belt seem too large, and the wild weeds, brambles, and grasses attain a luxuriance not often found in settled regions. At the same time, the planted fields appear singularly few and barren, while the sparsely scattered houses wear a surprising uniform aspect of age, squalor, and dilapidation. Without knowing why, one hesitates to ask directions from the gnarled, solitary figures spied now and then on crumbling doorsteps or in the sloping, rock-strewn meadows. Those figures are so silent and furtive that one feels somehow confronted by forbidden things with which it would be better to have nothing to do. When a rise in the road brings the mountains in view above the deep woods, the feeling of strange uneasiness is increased. The summits are too rounded and symmetrical to give a sense of comfort and naturalness. And sometimes the sky silhouettes with a special clearness the queer circles of tall stone pillars with which most of them are crowned. Gorges and ravines of problematical depth intersect the way, and the crude wooden bridges always seem of dubious safety. When the road dips again, there are stretches of marshland that one instinctively dislikes, and indeed almost fears at evening when unseen whippoorwills chatter and the fireflies come out in abnormal profusion to dance to the raucous, creepily insistent rhythms of stridently piping bullfrogs. The thin, shining line of the Miskatonic's upper reaches has an oddly serpent-like suggestion as it winds close to the feet of the domed hills among which it rises. As the hills draw nearer, one heeds their wooded sides more than their stone-crowned top. Those sides loom up so darkly and precipitously that one wishes they could keep their distance. But there is no road by which to escape them. Across a covered bridge, one sees a small village huddled between the stream and the vertical slope of Round Mountain, and wonders at the cluster of rotting gambrel roofs bespeaking an earlier architectural period than that of the neighboring region. It is not reassuring to see, on a closer glance, that most of the houses are deserted and falling to ruin, and that the broken steepled church now harbors the one slovenly mercantile establishment of the hamlet. One dreads to trust the tenebrous tunnel of the bridge, yet there is no way to avoid it. Once across, it is hard to prevent the impression of a faint, malign odor about the village street, as of the massed mold and decay of centuries. It is always a relief to get clear of the place, and to follow the narrow road around the base of the hills and across the level country beyond till it rejoins Aylesbury Pike. Afterwards, one sometimes learns that one has been through Dunwich. Outsiders visit Dunwich as seldom as possible, and since a certain season of horror, all the signboards pointing toward it have been taken down. The scenery, judged by an ordinary aesthetic canon, is more than commonly beautiful, yet there is no influx of artists or summer tourists. 2 centuries ago, when the talk of witch blood, Satan worship, and strange forest presences were not laughed at, it was the custom to give reasons for avoiding the locality. In our sensible age, since the Dunwich Horror of 1928 was hushed up by those who had the towns and the world's welfare at heart, people shun it without knowing exactly why. Perhaps one reason, though it cannot apply to uninformed strangers, is that the natives are now repellently decadent, having gone far along the path of retrogression so common in many New England backwaters. They have come to form a race by themselves, with the well-defined mental and physical stigmata of degeneracy and inbreeding. The average of their intelligence is woefully low, whilst their annals reek of overt viciousness and of half-hidden murders, incest, and deeds of almost unnameable violence and perversity. The old gentry, representing the two or three armiduous families which came from Salem in 1692, have kept somewhat above the general level of decay, though many branches are sunk into the sordid populace so deeply that only their names remain as a key to the origin of their disgrace. Some of the Whatleys and Bishops still send their eldest sons to Harvard and Miskatonic, though those sons seldom return to the moldering gambrel roofs under which they and their ancestors were born. Not one, even those who have the facts concerning the recent horror, can say just what is the matter with Dunwich. Though old legends speak of unhallowed rites and conclaves of the Indians amidst which they called forbidden shapes of shadow out of the great rounded hills, and made wild, orgiastic prayers that were answered by loud crackings and rumblings from the ground below. In 1747, the Reverend Abijah Hoadley, newly came to the Congregational Church at Dunwich Village, preached a memorable sermon on the close presence of Satan and his imps, in which he said, "It must be allowed that these blasphemies of an infernal train of demons are matters of too common knowledge to be denied. The cursed voices of Azazel and Buzrael and Beelzebub and Belial, being heard from underground by above, a score of credible witnesses now living. I myself did not more than a fortnight ago catch a very plain discourse of evil powers in the hill behind my house, wherein there were a rattling and rolling and groaning, screeching and hissing, such as no things of this earth could raise up, and which must needs to have come from those caves that only black magic can discover, and only the devil unlock." Mr. Hoadley disappeared soon after delivering the sermon, but the text, printed in Springfield, is still extant. Noises in the hills continue to be reported from year to year and still form a puzzle to geologists and physiographers. Other traditions tell of foul odors near the hill-crowning circles of stone pillars and of rushing, airy presences to be heard faintly at certain hours from stated points at the bottom of the great ravines. While still others try to explain the Devil's Hopyard, a bleak, blasted hillside where no tree, shrub, or grass blade will grow. Then, too, the natives are mortally afraid of the numerous whippoorwills which grow vocal on warm nights. It is vowed that the birds are psychopomps, lying in wait for the souls of the dying, and that they time their eerie cries in unison with the sufferer's struggling breath. If they can catch the fleeting soul when it leaves the body, they instantly flutter away, chittering in demoniac laughter. But if they fail, they subside gradually into a disappointed silence. These tales, of course, are obsolete and ridiculous because they come down from very old times. Dunwich is indeed ridiculously old. Older by far than any of the communities within 30 miles of it. South of the village, one may spy the cellar walls and chimney of the ancient Bishop House, which was built there before 1700, whilst the ruins of the mill at the falls, built in 1806, form the most modern piece of architecture to be seen. Industry did not flourish here, and the 19th century factory movement proved short-lived. Oldest of all are the great rings of rough-hewn stone columns on the hilltops, but these are more generally attributed to the Indians than to the settlers. Deposits of skull and bones, found within these circles and around the sizable table-like rock on Sentinel Hill, sustain the popular belief that such spots were once the burial places of the Bokumtuks, even though many ethnologists, disregarding the absurd improbability of such a theory, persist in believing the remains Caucasian. Chapter 2. It was in the township of Dunwich, in a large and partly inhabited farmhouse set against the hillside 4 miles from the village, and 1.5 miles from any other dwelling, that Wilbur Whatley was born, at 5 a.m. on Sunday, the 2nd of February, 1913. This date was recalled because it was Candlemas, which people in Dunwich curiously observe under another name, and because the noises in the hills had sounded, and all the dogs of the countryside had barked persistently throughout the night before. Less worthy of notice was the fact that the mother was one of the decadent Whatleys, a somewhat deformed, unattractive albino woman of 35, living with an aged and half-insane father about whom the most frightful tales of wizardry had been whispered in his youth. Lavinia Whatley had no known husband, but according to the custom of the region, made no attempt to disavow the child. Concerning the other side, of whose ancestry the country folk might, and did, speculate as wildly as they chose. On the contrary, she seemed strangely proud of the dark, goatish-looking infant who formed such a contrast to her own sickly and pink-eyed albinism, and was heard to mutter many curious prophecies about its unusual powers and tremendous future. Lavinia was one who would be apt to mutter such things, for she was a lone creature given to wandering amidst thunderstorms in the hills and trying to read the great odorous books which her father had inherited through 2 centuries of Whatleys, and which were fast falling to pieces with age and wormholes. She had never been to school, but was filled with disjointed scraps of ancient lore that old Whatley had taught her. The remote farmhouse had always been feared because of the old Whatley's reputation for black magic, and the unexplained death by violence of Mrs. Whatley when Lavinia was 12 years old had not helped to make the place popular. Lavinia was fond of wild and grandiose dreams and singular occupations. Nor was her leisure much taken up by household chores in a home from which all standards of order and cleanliness had long since disappeared. There was a hideous screaming which echoed above even the hill noises and the dogs barking on the night Wilbur was born, but no known doctor or midwife presided at his coming. Neighbors knew nothing of him till 1 week afterward, when old Whatley drove his sleigh through the snow into Dunwich Village and discoursed incoherently to the group of loungers at Osborne's general store. There seemed to be a change in the old man, an added element of furtiveness in the clouded brain, which subtly transformed him from an object to a subject of fear. Though he was not one to be perturbed by any common family event. Amidst it all, he showed some trace of the pride later noticed in his daughter, and what he said of the child's paternity was remembered by many of his hearers years later. "I don't care what the folks think. If Lavinny's boy looked like his pa, he wouldn't look like nothing ye expect. Ye needn't think the only folks is the folks hereabouts. Lavinny's read some, and has seed some things most of ye only tell about. I calculate her man is as good a husband as ye can find this side of Aylbury. And if ye knowed as much about the hills as I do, ye wouldn't ask no better church wedding, nor hern. Let me tell ye something. Some day, you folks will hear a child of Lavinny's a Collins father's name at the top of Sentinel Hill." The only person who saw Wilbur during the first month of his life were old Zachariah Whatley of the undecayed Whatleys and Earl Sawyer's common-law wife, Mamie Bishop. Mimi's visit was frankly one of curiosity, and her subsequent tales did justice to her observations. But Zachariah came to lead a pair of Alderney cows, which old Whatley had brought of his son Curtis. This marked the beginning of a course of cattle buying on the part of small Wilbur's family, which ended only in 1928, when the Dunwich Horror came and went. Yet, at no time did the ramshackle Whatley barn seem overcrowded with livestock. There came a period when people were curious enough to steal up and count the herd that grazed precariously on the steep hillside above the old farmhouse, and they could never find more than 10 or 12 anemic, bloodless-looking specimens. Evidently, some blight or distemper, perhaps sprung from the unwholesome pasturage or the diseased fungi and timbers of the filthy barn, caused a heavy mortality amongst the Whatley animals. Odd wounds or sores, having something of the aspect of incisions, seemed to afflict the visible cattle, and once or twice during the earlier months, certain callers fancied they could discern similar sores about the throats of the gray, unshaven old man and his slatternly, crinkly-haired albino daughter. In the spring, after Wilbur's birth, Lavinia resumed her customary rambles in the hills, bearing in her misproportioned arms the swarthy child. Public interest in the Whatleys subsided after most of the country folk had seen the baby, and no one bothered to comment on the swift development which the newcomer seemed every day to exhibit. Wilbur's growth was indeed phenomenal, for within 3 months of his birth, he had attained a size and muscular power not usually found in infants under a full year of age. His motions and even his vocal sounds showed a restraint and deliberateness highly peculiar in an infant, and no one was really unprepared when, at 7 months, he began to walk, unassisted, with falterings which another month was sufficient to remove. It was somewhat after this time, on Halloween, that a great blaze was seen at midnight on the top of Sentinel Hill, where the old table-like stone stands amidst its tumulus of ancient bones. Considerable talk was started when Silas Bishop, one of the undecayed bishops, mentioned having seen the boy running sturdily up that hill ahead of his mother about an hour before the blaze was remarked. Silas was rounding up a stray heifer, but he nearly forgot his mission when he fleetingly spied the two figures in the dim light of his lantern. They darted, almost noiselessly, through the underbrush, and the astonished watcher seemed to think that they were entirely unclothed. Afterward, he could not be sure about the boy, who may have had some kind of a fringed belt and a pair of dark blue trunks or trousers on. Wilbur was never subsequently seen alive and conscious without complete and tightly buttoned attire. The disarrangement, or threatened disarrangement, of which always seemed to fill him with anger and alarm. His contrast with his squalid mother and grandfather, in this respect, was thought very notable until the horror of 1828 suggested the most valid of reasons. The next January, gossips were mildly interested in the fact that Lavinia's black brat had commenced to talk, and at the age of only 11 months. His speech was somewhat remarkable both because of its difference from the ordinary accents of the region and because it displayed a freedom from infantile lisping of which many children of 3 or 4 might well be proud. The boy was not talkative, yet when he spoke, he seemed to reflect some elusive element wholly unpossessed by Dunwich and his denizens. The strangeness did not reside in what he said, or even the simple idioms he used, but seemed vaguely linked with his intonation or with the internal organs that produce the spoken sounds. His facial aspect, too, was remarkable for its maturity, for though he shared his mother and grandfather's chinlessness, His firm and precociously shaped nose united with the expression on his large, dark, almost Latin eyes to give him an air of quasi-adulthood and well-nigh preternatural intelligence. He was, however, exceedingly ugly despite his appearance of brilliancy, there being something almost goatish or animalistic about his thick lips, large pored yellow skin, coarsely crinkled hair, and oddly elongated ears. He was soon disliked even more decidedly than his mother and grandsire, and all conjectures about him were spiced with references to the bygone magic of old Whatley, and how the hills once shook when he shrieked the dreadful name of Yog-Sothoth in the midst of a circle of stones with a great book open in his arms before him. Dogs abhorred the boy, and he was always obliged to take various defensive measures against their barking menace. And that's all for this week. Thank you so much for being here. If you would like, join me on the Whispering Willow Tea Room on Patreon for every episode early and ad-free. Until next week, take care, and I'll see you soon.